Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific Daylight Time. And that means we can take your calls. If you'd like to be on the program today, we'd be very happy to have you join us. And if you would do so with a question that you may have about the Bible or Christianity, or if you have a difference of opinion from that of the host on any subject and you'd like to discuss it here, well, this is a great opportunity for you to do so. We have 1 hour together, and our lines are wide open right now. Not one caller waiting. Well, that's not true. Now there's a caller waiting, but that the status does change every few minutes. If you'd like to be on the program, there's a toll-free number, and that is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090, and I'd be glad to take your calls as they come in. And you can call on any subject related to Christianity or the Bible or religion or ethics or anything that's of interest to you as a Christian or might be interesting to Christians. And again, my name is Steve Gregg. I'm not really representing any particular denomination. My viewpoints I express are those of myself and, for all I know, perhaps nobody else. But if my views are off, you can always call to correct them. That's an open forum here. So let's go to the phone lines now. We'll talk to some of these. The number is 1-800-438-5090. First caller is Bobby calling from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Bobby. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4.
Mm-hmm.
And this is for my aunt. She doesn't understand who the sons of God are, and then she does in these verses, and then when he says, my spirit shall not strive with man forever.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, those are interesting and difficult verses, and one can be forgiven for not understanding them since there's actually a number of interpretations of them.
Mm-hmm.
The passage says that the time came, and this is just shortly before the flood of Noah.
Uh-huh.
The time came when the sons of God looked upon the daughters of men and saw that they were beautiful, and they took of them wives for themselves, as many as they wished, I guess. And then they had children. They had families. Now, in that same context, it mentions there were, the Hebrew says, Nephilim in the world in those days. The King James and many translations have translated Nephilim as giants. So most translations say there were giants in the world in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and children were born to them. It says the same were, significant, mighty men in the world. And then God said, he said, my spirit will not always strive with man. And he says, I'll give him 120 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I understand is there, something happened. We have to decide who the sons of God were, perhaps.
That's what I was wondering.
Right. Right. But whatever happened, there were these marriages that produced some offspring, and it was definitely for the worst. It was not an improvement. It was a detriment to the world, so that the world eventually, we find, was full of violence and evil. And God said, I'm going to only give mankind another 120 years, and then I'm going to wipe them all out. So
that's what that means.
Yes, yeah. I mean, when God says of man, his days shall be 120 years, some people make the mistake of thinking that God is saying from now on people will live to be 120 years old.
Okay.
But that's not his meaning. That never happened. I mean, in the days before the flood and even after the flood, people lived a lot longer than 120 years. And then when their lifespan began to diminish many generations after the flood, it never really stopped at 120. In the days of Moses, although Moses lived to be 120 years old himself, he said in Psalm 90, which Moses wrote, that people's average lifespan was 70 years. So there really never was a time where the lifespan of man, or even the average lifespan, was around 120 years. So it means, I believe, that God said, I'm going to give them 120 years. The whole human race has another 120 years until I wipe them out.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, many people believe that about 120 years before the flood, that God warned Noah about the coming flood, or shortly after that.
Yeah.
Now, the sons of God, who were they? Obviously, they are contrasted with the daughters of men. You've got sons of God, mm-hmm. obviously the male partners here, and the daughters of men, the female partners. daughters of men, of course, strikes us as simply meaning humans, human women.
Mm-hmm.
And the contrast with the sons of God has led many to believe that we're not talking about human men. Because
angels.
There's, you know, some people believe it's talking about angels. That was the view of many of the rabbis to this passage, and there are many Christians who hold that view also. And it is one of the possible views, that it was angels who became attracted to human women and began to have relations with them and so forth. And on this suggestion, it is said that the Nephilim, or the so-called giants, were the offspring of these unnatural unions between angels and humans. And therefore, the Nephilim, they say, were some kind of a half-human, half-demon, we might say. Because these angels...
Bad angels.
Well, that's it. Once these... If angels came down and married women,
mm-hmm.
they were leaving their proper abode.
That's forbidden, right?
Right. They clearly would have become bad angels at that point, yeah. There is reference in 2 Peter chapter 2 and in Jude to certain angels who left their first estate and did not keep to their proper domain. And it does not say that this was the occasion
mm-hmm.
that he's talking about. You know, there are some fallen angels somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And when they fell, we do not know. But some people believe this was the occasion of that. And so that is one view. It's very common among
mm-hmm.
Jews, very common among Christians. And but there are some problems that that have made many, including myself, question whether this view is correct. And not the least of which is that Jesus said in Matthew chapter 20 that angels do not marry, and they're not given in marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And these sons of God married women and had children, started families with them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's one thing to suggest, although I'm not sure I would suggest it, but some might suggest that, demonic angels might molest women or might,
mm-hmm.
you know, otherwise sexually harass women, but
mm-hmm.
but to marry them, settle down, have kids, and raise a family with them, that seems very strange.
Especially
since angels are not physical beings. Angels are spirits. So many feel that this angel theory is not really very adequate to answer to
mm-hmm.
this these considerations. And so many believe that the sons of God in Genesis 6 has essentially the same meaning that it has in the New Testament when it talks about the sons of God, where it says in John chapter 1, verse 12, as many as received Christ, to them he gave the power to become sons of God. Or it says in 1 John chapter 3, beloved, now we are the sons of God, and it does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him. So that sons of God, at least in the New Testament, has the meaning of people of God, godly people. And the term is used sometimes that way in the Old Testament. For example, in Hosea chapter 1, the Jewish people, when they are in rebellion against God, God says, you are not my people. But he says the time will come when he will restore them to himself and they will be called sons of the living God. So both the Old and the New Testament do use that term
uh-huh.
to speak of godly people. On the other hand, the book of Job uses that term, and there's many who feel that it uses that term as angels there. So we've got really some mixed messages here. The term sons of God in Job appears to refer to angels, but in many other passages it refers to human beings.
Uh-huh.
Now, which it means in Genesis 6 is disputed, but I think probably in Genesis 6 it's referring to human beings. And my reason for saying so
uh-huh.
is that the author of Genesis, who is Moses,
uh-huh.
introduces the activities of the sons of God in Genesis 6 without any explanation of who they are, as if he expects his readers to know what that term refers to,
uh-huh.
who are the sons of God. And if it was angels or if it was supernatural beings, then he's introducing this concept without any explanation and without giving his readers any reason to know that that's what he means. Whereas if he's talking about human godly people, he has been describing such people in the previous chapter. In chapter 5, there is the generations that descended from Seth. And many of them were godly people, including Enoch and Noah
uh-huh.
and apparently some of the others. And so in Genesis 5, just before this passage, the author of Genesis has focused on a family that produced some godly offspring, some godly people, in other words. And so when he, in the very next, at the very beginning of chapter 6, says, now the sons of God at a certain time began to marry other women who were not of God,
mm-hmm.
just merely human women who did not have any qualifications. We called daughters of God because they were not godly. Well, then this began to be to cause some breakdown in the integrity of the godly line.
Oh, I see where you're going with that now.
You see?
Yeah.
And so the world became corrupted by it. And so many people feel that this is referring to godly people rather than angels. And we really can't settle the question beyond dispute. My own opinion, if someone wishes for it, is I think the idea that it is humans is less problematic than the idea that it's angels.
So you think it's humans?
I think it flows more naturally from the previous material.
It's more understandable, too.
Yeah, and then you don't have to explain how it is that angels would be able to reproduce with human women. Because even animals that are very much like us, I mean, the animals that are closest to us in resemblance and DNA can't reproduce with us because their DNA is not identical with ours. And, apes, they say, have, 97% shared DNA with human beings.
Okay,
and yet
that's
enough difference that there can be no reproduction between the two species.
Yes.
So, I mean, anyone who reproduces with human women has to have 100% human DNA. And where do angels, who are spirits, get human DNA from?
Okay. Well, Steve, I thank you very much for this, and I shall call my aunt, and I wrote down a bunch of stuff, and I will try to explain to her from your mouth.
Okay, I'm sure that she'll be disappointed because I didn't give a straight answer. Generally speaking, it's hard to know which view is correct, but
there's so much in the Bible that's not, you can't explain, you know.
That's true.
We won't know till we get to heaven.
That's right.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Bobby, thank you for your call.
All right. God bless you.
God bless you, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Now, that opens a line for you if you'd like to be on the program. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. Our next caller is going to be Dion, calling from Pacific Grove in California. And we have lines open for you. If you have a question about the Bible or a disagreement, feel free to call me at 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. And, I mentioned last week, near the end of the week, that we've been a little over a month, we've been broadcasting in Paradise, California area, in Chico area, and had not yet received any callers in that month from that listening audience. And then on Monday, one person from that audience called, but it was at the end of the show and we weren't able to get her call on. But we're still looking forward to our first conversation with somebody from that audience. And, of course, people listening from any audience are welcome to join us. The number is 1-800-438-5090. Dion, thank you for calling. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about the gift of prophecy. And I understand in the Old Testament how, you know, we receive prophecy from the prophet. But in reading the New Testament, when Paul talks about us, that prophecy is one of the greatest gifts and that we should pray for the gift of prophecy. But I just don't have an understanding of what prophecy is, and that if I were to pray for this gift, how I would even know that I had the gift of prophecy and how it would come about.
Right. Well, that's a very good question and very legitimate. We have Paul talking about this gift primarily in 1 Corinthians chapters 12 through 14. And we mainly have to read between the lines because Paul does not set out to give a systematic teaching on any of the gifts of the Spirit. He writes to the Corinthians, who already knew a great deal about the gifts of the Spirit, but they were kind of misusing them. So what Paul writes to them is more or less trying to correct their wrong use of the gifts. And we kind of have to read between the lines to figure, well, what was their understanding and Paul's understanding about this. It would appear that the gift of prophecy was simply the ability to speak a word directly from God to the church, which is what the gift of prophecy was in the Old Testament also. Now, in addition to that, just to muddy the waters a little bit, there was also an office of prophet in the early church. There were people who held the office of prophet. Now, you might speak in the gift of prophecy, and still not have the office of a prophet. So the office of a prophet is not exactly the same thing. And we know this because the Bible indicates that prophesying or speaking with the gift of prophecy is sort of a universal thing that all Christians can do, and at least if God wishes for them to, and that everyone should seek to do so. But on the other hand, the office of a prophet, the Bible makes it very clear, not everyone is called to the office of a prophet. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12, are all apostles, are all prophets, are all teachers? And he's implying the answer is no, that God has not placed all to be prophets and apostles. Likewise, in Ephesians 4, 11, Paul said God gave some to be apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers. So Paul makes it very clear, not all are called to be prophets, but some are. But apart from that consideration, anyone might prophesy, and everyone who has not prophesied should pray that they might. I will not say with any certainty that I have ever prophesied, and I have prayed, as Paul said to do, pray for that gift, but it would appear that God usually has me do something else. I mean, teaching is a different gift than prophecy, and I'm mainly a teacher, but I would still be glad to prophesy. But how would you know if you were doing it? Well, I think the prophets almost always knew when they were prophesying. And I think in the New Testament, the gift of prophecy isn't really different than the Old Testament gift. Now, most people will tell you different than that, and so I'm just telling you I think they're wrong. Most people will say the gift of prophecy in the Old Testament differs from the gift of prophecy in the New Testament. And here's how they say it differs. They say in the Old Testament, prophecy consisted largely of predicting the future. But in the New Testament, prophecy is primarily about foretelling God's will and God's mind to the people of God. In other words, perhaps God speaking through a prophet in the church or prophesying that the church is displeasing to him in some way and needs to repent, as we find Jesus doing in the book of Revelation to the seven churches there, through the spirit of prophecy there, speaking to the seven churches. Something like that. For a prophet to speak from God, telling the church, you need to repent of such and such, or giving a word of encouragement to the church or something from God, but not necessarily predicting anything. That is, that's what people call foretelling. So predicting things is foretelling. Foretelling. But just speaking out the mind of God about some issue, it would be foretelling. Now, what you'll often hear, in fact, almost everybody will say this, and I think they're quite wrong, because it's just not biblical what they're saying. They say that the Old Testament prophets were primarily into foretelling, and the New Testament prophets were primarily into forthtelling. Well, this just isn't true at all. If you read the Old Testament prophets, which I guess not enough Christians have done to know that they're wrong in saying this, the Old Testament prophets did a lot more forthtelling than foretelling. If you read the book of Isaiah or Jeremiah, for every prediction, there's got to be several chapters of denunciation for sin and call to repentance and promises that God's making of how he's going to redeem and so forth. But as far as specific predictions about this is going to happen, they are outnumbered in the Old Testament prophets by simply what we might call sermons of God preaching at the people. And so to characterize the Old Testament prophet as one who primarily foretells is to miss out on the majority of what the prophets actually did prophesy. And then when you come to the New Testament, to suggest that New Testament prophets don't foretell, but they forthtell, is quite wrong, too. We only have one example in the Bible of a man who is called to be a prophet, although there were many. I take it back, there are others who are called prophets, but we don't have any specimens of their prophesying. The only man in the New Testament that is called a prophet, and we have a specimen of his prophesying, is Agabus. Agabus is mentioned twice in the book of Acts, in chapter 11, and again, I think around chapter 20 or 21. And in both cases, he prophesies. And in both cases, he tells the future. In the first case, Agabus predicts a famine was coming. In the second case, his prophecy was more personal. It was to Paul, saying that Paul would be bound by the Jews when he goes to Jerusalem. But here we have a New Testament prophet foretelling, and Old Testament prophets forthtelling. It's kind of the reverse of what most people say. The truth is that in the Old and the New Testament, prophets would foretell and they would forthtell. I mean, God does both of these things through the Old Testament prophets, and we find in the New Testament spirit of prophecy both happening too. So the main thing that would make a prophecy different than, let's say, an ordinary sermon would be when a prophet speaks as a prophet, he speaks as if he is God, because God speaks through the prophet in the first person. God says, I will do this. I have this opinion of this situation. I have this against you. You know, I call upon you to do such and such. In other words, it's like God is speaking as if, you know, speaking from heaven, but through a human mouth. Whereas sermons, such as we normally hear in church, are usually a man speaking about God, about the Bible, and certainly not speaking as God's mouthpiece. And that's fine, because sermons are not the same thing as prophecies. And that's another thing where I think you'll hear wrong teaching a lot, especially in churches that are, I just say non-charismatic churches. They'll often say that prophesying is just inspired preaching. Even the Living Bible changes the word prophesying in the New Testament to inspired preaching. But there's a difference between inspired preaching and prophesying, because a preacher may be very inspired and preach a great deal about God, about Jesus, but a prophet speaks as God, as God's mouth. And so the prophets in the Old Testament and the New would speak as if it was Jesus speaking or God speaking to them. And how someone would know that they have a genuine prophecy to present to the church is something I cannot answer, because I have never done it. I have never had that gift, as far as I know. And for that reason, I can't tell you, and I've often wondered it myself, you know, how would I know if something that comes to my mind as a prophecy was really from God or not? And apparently, that's the difference between a person who is a prophet and somebody who's just an ordinary person like me who might on occasion prophesy. A person who is a prophet is somebody who has a pretty good feel for those things and is can be relied on, that when they speak prophetically, it really is real. But someone like you or me, who may not be a prophet, if God gives us a prophet, we might not be sure. That he might give us a prophecy, we might not be sure if that's what it is. And I suppose if we would speak such a thing out, that's why Paul said, let the prophet speak two or three and let the others judge. Because there's times when, you know, we might think we're given a prophecy and it's not real. It's not really a prophecy from God, in which case there should be some judgment made by the church so that both we and our listeners can know that we're not really speaking from God as we think we are. It's delicate to me. I don't know. There are people I know who have been very bold in prophesying. Some of them have been wrong and have proved that they weren't prophets after all. But there have been a few who, every time they've spoken prophetically, what they've said seems to be true and seems to have come true. And that being the case seems to mark them as the genuine article. But I can't tell you how you would know if you're going to prophesy, you know. First of all, if you're in a non-charismatic church, they probably don't welcome prophesying there. I was raised a Baptist, for example, and most Baptist churches would not welcome somebody to stand up in the service and say, thus saith the Lord, I have this and this against you, or whatever. It's possible that many Pentecostal and charismatic churches wouldn't appreciate that kind of prophecy either, but at least in those churches, they believe in the gift of prophecy. You see, a lot of churches, they don't believe the gift of prophecy is for today. They believe that was a gift that was for the early days of the church, and so they don't worry about, you know, how to know if you have a prophecy or not, because they don't believe it's genuine today at all.
Okay, well, thank you so much. That was a very helpful answer, and I appreciate kind of the thoroughness of even receiving more than I thought I was going to get from the answer, so thank you.
All right, always exceeding expectations here.
Thanks, well, have a good day.
God bless you, Dion.
Thank
Bye-bye
you.
Now. Okay, we're going to talk to another Steve. My name is Steve, by the way, if you don't know. This is the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and our caller is named Steve from Portland, Oregon. Steve, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
All right. Well, thank you. Just wanted to make a comment on the first caller. I found her question and your answer to be really interesting. I just wanted to give you my perspective and find out what you thought about that. The sons of God is very interesting in the fact that when they marry the daughters of men, there is an offspring that is unlike any other offspring that's been mentioned in the Bible up until this point. And these offspring, the Nephilim, that word Nephilim actually connotates somebody who's like a bully or a tyrant. Not only are these people giants, but they're also bullies and tyrants, kind of like Goliath was a giant. And they're not necessarily positive people, which gives credibility to the sons of God being fallen angels. Because had they been mere men, as the Bible has in the first part of Genesis, there would be no reason to say, okay, these mere men are marrying these women, because it was normal. They made an exception and said, hey, these are sons of God marrying the daughters of men. Now, when we look at that, it is kind of a difficult area to discuss. It's kind of hard for people to understand. But if you look at the beginnings of the relations between spirits having sex with physical beings, you can look back in Genesis when Eve, when she was questioned by God, when he said, what is this you have done? She gave two responses. She gave one being, I ate of the fruit. Two being, I was beguiled. A lot of Bibles say beguiled as being misled or lied to, but if you look at the account of the conversations between the serpent and Eve, he never once said anything that was not true. A lot of people will say, well, he said that if you eat this, you will surely die. But God himself said afterwards that, you know, there is a way that she won't die by eating from the tree of life, which she won't die. So God did say that, yeah, if you eat it, you will die, but then he goes on to say that actually you won't die, because if you take the tree of life, you will live forever. And then now going back to what Eve said about the beguilement, beguiling means to be seduced. That means sexual seduction. And with that, the one thing that a lot of people, that's hard to see in the narrative of that part in Genesis, when the Lord asks, who told you you were naked? Now, there is no account of anybody saying that you were naked, but there's only three people in the garden, and it wasn't Adam that told her that she was naked. She didn't say that she was naked. So it must be the serpent that told her that she was naked and told her to the point that she was ashamed. And that is where the seduction takes place, is that a lot of people don't catch that. You have the serpent, and later on the Bible it says that...
Let me ask you something, Steve. Steve, are you saying that one of the offspring of Eve was actually an offspring of the serpent?
Well, if you look at the nature of Cain...
okay, so you believe that. You believe the serpent seed doctrine, in other words, right?
I believe what?
The serpent seed doctrine.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not for sure anything about that. I'm just going off of what I read.
Okay, I think you've read something besides the Bible to get a lot of that out of there, because that doctrine is an established, frankly, heretical doctrine. It's taught by William Branham, and it's taught by many today. It tends to be taught by white supremacist and neo-Nazi types. So I'm not saying you're those things, but that's a view that is commonly taught by them. They teach that Eve had a sexual relationship with the serpent, Cain was the offspring, and depending on who you talk to, some say Cain was really the progenitor of the Jewish race, and that they're not really from Abraham at all. They're really from Cain, and therefore they are the serpent's seed, and which is the basis of a lot of anti-Semitism. Some say that Cain, was not necessarily the progenitor of the Jewish race, but of some other kind of corrupt non-human race. Certainly the Bible says nothing
about that.
Yeah, that's a good thing, because it's a good thing you don't, because that's a really, of course, evil doctrine. But I want to just respond to a lot of things you said, because you're telling me what the Hebrew means about things. It doesn't sound to me like you're much of a Hebrew scholar. Neither am I, but I do look up things in credible lexicons. And let's start with the idea that there's any indication in Genesis chapter 3 that Eve and the serpent had anything like a sexual relationship. Well, there's nothing to suggest it. Beguiled, to say that...
Speak more on the seduction.
Okay, you said that the word beguiled means seduced.
Well,
and you want that to mean sexually seduced.
I think seduction is the best one that fits of all the definitions that are given for beguiled.
Well, Paul doesn't agree with you. Paul doesn't agree with you, because in 1 Timothy chapter 2, Paul said that the woman was deceived. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul said that the serpent deceived or beguiled Eve, And he was afraid that the church might be beguiled in a similar way by false teachers. I don't think he's referring. He's not referring to sexual.
On the deception, if you look at the account, you have to tell me where he deceived her, because everything that nothing he told her was a lie.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. He told her some things that were true, but okay, hang on. You can deceive someone by. Okay, yeah, just listen up. You can deceive someone by telling them a half truth, and concealing the half that they need to know more. God told them, "In the day you eat of it, you will surely die."
Okay.
The devil said, "You won't surely die." Now, okay, God said one thing. The devil said something else. Who was lying?
Okay, but then God goes on to say, and actually she didn't die. So
well, hang on. Who was lying? Excuse me. Who lied then? You're saying God lied.
No, I'm not saying.
Okay, well, wait. If God told the truth, excuse me, Steve. If God told the truth, then the devil lied, because the devil contradicted him. Is that right?
Okay. Well, wait a second.
So you have to decide: did God lie or did the devil lie?
Well, there's two comments on what God says about the tree. He says that, well, the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. But then, in the next chapters, he says, okay, you should naturally die unless you eat from the tree of life. So he goes on to expound on that comment.
Wait, no, he's not going to. Wait, excuse me. No, he's not going to let them eat of the tree of life.
I'm sorry. What did you say?
God did not let them eat of the tree of life because of
No. He said if you eat of the tree of life, you shall live forever, which is the way not to die. Or at least
not what he said. He says lest they eat of the tree of life and live forever, God prevented that from happening, so they wouldn't live forever.
So she actually wouldn't die unless she eats from the tree of life, correct?
If she ate from the tree of life, she would not die. That's correct.
Correct. So then there's some truth in what he says. That when God says that you surely die, then he goes on to say that there is a way to live forever, which is the tree of life.
I'm not really sure where you're going with that. The devil didn't say anything about eating of the tree of life. What God tells us is if Adam and Eve had been permitted to continually eat from the tree of life, they would have continually lived. Okay, but that's irrelevant to the promise that the devil made, which was a direct contradiction of the threat that God made. I mean, if we have God saying, you will die, you will surely die that day.
Okay.
The devil says you will not. Now, one of those two is lying.
Okay, now he says you should surely lie, but he says, and now at least he put out his hand and take also for the tree of life and eat and live forever. So there's a chance actually not to die, and the lady actually didn't die after she ate it. Was God lying?
I think you're quite confused. There was not a chance that they would not die. God made sure that they would not eat of the tree of life, so that his threat would come true. The fact that there was a tree of life there, and that if someone had eaten of it, they would live forever, does not mean that they had the chance to do it, because God made sure they didn't have the chance to do it. God put a flaming sword and an angel there, a cherub, to guard the way to keep them from doing it. So God kept his threat.
Okay, so did Eve die after she ate the fruit?
Yes, but not immediately. But I think that most Christians would say they died spiritually that day, which could be a true statement. The evidence would be in the fact that they were sinners from then on, and that we are dead in trespasses and sins, according to Ephesians 2:1, and that Adam and Eve became dead in trespasses and sins. I'm not sure if that's the right interpretation, but it certainly is a common one and a possible one. I think it's also possible that God said, you will die that day. But what he did is he took a sacrifice of two animals and killed them as sacrifices in the place of Adam and Eve, so that they died in the person of a substitute, just like we do. We died in Christ. Christ died as our substitute.
So God wasn't lying when he said you should surely die. He necessarily wasn't lying about that, because there is a way that you can live forever. But talk to me about the serpent telling Eve that she's naked, because God asked, who told you you were naked?
Okay,
and nobody
else
there can tell him
they're
naked.
First of all, let me talk.
Where does it come from?
If you want me to talk about it, you're going to have to stop talking so I can talk, okay?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay,
go ahead.
But the serpent never told them that they were naked, okay? There's nothing there that says anything about the serpent telling them they're naked. It says... It says in verse 7, then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. Why? Because their eyes were open to that fact.
Okay, well, how do you gain knowledge? You gain knowledge through hearing, and hearing through understanding.
No. In this case, they got knowledge. I'm going to put you on hold so I can talk for a second, all right? Hang on. In this case, they didn't gain knowledge through hearing. it says they gained knowledge through seeing. It says their eyes were opened. Now, if your eyes are opened, and you then know something that you didn't know before your eyes were open, it is strongly suggested you learned it by seeing it, not by hearing it. The devil didn't have to tell them they were naked, nor did God. Adam didn't have to tell Eve, and she didn't have to tell Adam. Their eyes were opened, and they knew. So, in other words, you're reading stuff into this passage, and I don't want to speak about your motives because I don't know you. Your motives may not be as bad as they could be. I think a lot of people have sort of a sexual obsession, and maybe even a slightly perverted one, and they love to see sexual nuances in stories where there aren't any. And there aren't any here. There's no nuances about Eve having a sexual relationship with the devil. And so to read that in there, especially when you have to read contrary to what it actually says, and you have to claim that it means something that's the opposite of what the words say, I'm sorry, it's just not treating the Bible respectably. And then when you come to the Nephilim in chapter 6, I need to clarify something too. You said the word Nephilim in the Hebrew means something like a bully. Well, that's not correct. The Hebrew word Nephilim is a very hard word to translate because no Hebrew scholar knows what it actually means. The word is found only twice in all Hebrew literature. And the both times are in the Bible. One is in Genesis 6, which we've been discussing. The other is in Numbers chapter 14, where the Hebrew spies come back from the land of Canaan, and they say, we've seen the Nephilim there. And we were like grasshoppers in their sight. So in other words, we figure the Nephilim must have been big compared to the Jews. But the point here is, okay, the Nephilim were big. Maybe they were giants. Maybe they were something else big. We don't know. But the fact is the word Nephilim is a mystery to Hebrew scholars. It doesn't have an obvious meaning. And there's not enough occurrences of the word in the Hebrew text or Hebrew literature to know, you know, what it means. But it probably means something like a giant, since the only evidence we have about its meaning is in Numbers chapter 14, where the Hebrews said we were like grasshoppers in their sight, which probably doesn't mean that we were hopping around on six legs. It probably means we were like insects, small compared to them. And so I think the traditional translation giants is probably pretty good. Now, that the Nephilim were bad guys is very reasonable to assume, but to suggest that they were the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men is to go beyond what anything in the Bible suggests. The Bible does not say that these Nephilim were the offspring of these marriages. In fact, the way it's worded, it raises serious questions about that. In Genesis 6:4, it says, there were Nephilim in the earth in those days. And also afterward, when the sons of God came in and the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Now it says, there were Nephilim in the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God married the daughters of men and had children. That sounds like it's saying there were Nephilim in the earth before and after that time. Furthermore, if the Nephilim were indeed the products of angels marrying women, and we argue, as you do, that you know these Nephilim were like supernatural beings and therefore couldn't have been the product of merely human parents, then why do we have them again in Numbers chapter 14 after the flood? The flood came for the express purpose of destroying the evil, corrupt society before Noah's time, including the Nephilim. And only Noah's family made it through the flood, and all humans after that descended from Noah's family. And hundreds of years later, the Israelites found Nephilim in Canaan. Did angels come down again a second time after the flood and do this? The Bible doesn't say so. It seems more likely that the Nephilim were genetic giants, of which we know many have existed. I mean, skeletons of giants have been found. We're not talking about Jack and the Beanstalk type giants that are as big as a building. We're talking about men who are as big as Goliath, who are about 10 feet tall. And, there's been plenty of evidence that humans that size have lived before in history. And they're just, you know, genetic monstrosities, but they're not supernatural. And so you're reading a lot into the passage that isn't there, and I have a real hard time believing, Steve, that you're just getting that from reading the Bible. It sounds so much like what I've heard many teachers teach who have an axe to grind, an agenda, and they aren't really Bible scholars. They want to teach this serpent seed doctrine, and normally, now maybe you're not doing this, But normally they're trying to do it to make Cain out to be a half-human, half-demonic person, and then make him the progenitor of either the Jews or the blacks or some race that the people don't like. And to me, that's just not using the Bible, honestly. And I think it's something we need to be very careful about, is not to misuse the Bible. Okay, you're back on, Steve.
Okay. Okay, got back along there. And I'm just really confused about a point that you brought up. You said that it came through sight, but the Lord said that they were told something. So when he said that you were told something, he wasn't necessarily being,
God didn't say that they were told that. He said, who told you? You were naked.
So
he didn't...
That's implying that they were told something, some new information.
It's implying something. He's saying, how do you know, basically? How do you know you were naked? Did someone tell you? Of course, well, we know. The answer is their eyes were open and they saw. That's what the Bible actually tells us.
How do you know you're doing something wrong unless somebody tells you?
You know it by eating the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and your eyes are opened, and you gain the knowledge of good and evil.
Okay, so gaining the knowledge...
That's how it happened to them. That's how it happened to them.
So say the gain knowledge through sight, which if you see something, before you eat the fruit is one thing, but after you eat the fruit is another thing. But if you're told something, that changes your knowledge. If you're told something, we learn by hearing.
Okay, Steve, hey, I'll tell you what. I'll let you believe whatever you want to believe. I've got my lines full, and I don't really think that you're open-minded. I think you have an axe to grind for a doctrine that doesn't have any biblical support. But I do thank you for calling. You're welcome to do so anytime that I've got time to talk.
Yeah, I just wanted to get your opinion about that.
All right. I appreciate you calling.
All right.
All right, bye now. Let's talk to Karen from Portland, who's been waiting a while. Karen, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I went ahead and tried the forum, the theos.org.
Yes.
And as an LDS person. And I just got such a great welcome. And Darren from Houston had some great questions. I went ahead and I was down in the set topic called Mormonism, and I kind of broke it off into sections because questions get complicated.
Sure. Yeah, just for a minute, Karen, let me interrupt because some of our listeners may not have understood what you're referring to. There is a internet chat forum that's linked with our ministry, and it's theos.org, T-H-E-O-S, which is the Greek word for God, .org. And there you can log on and you can write questions about many different things, and either I or someone else will post an answer, and there can be dialogue. And so that's what Karen's referring to. She's been to this forum. And Karen is a Mormon, or a Latter-day Saint, and so she's saying she posted some things. Okay, I think our listeners will be caught up with you now, Karen. Go ahead.
Okay, and I feel like I did such an unprofessional job. I didn't know if those portions can be cleared off, or if I need, if I should put a little apology in there. I'm not a professional representative.
Okay, so you would like to you'd like to edit them or
well, have them taken off except
for
Darren's
them.
Question was so great. You know, he was inquiring about how I felt about something, and I thought that was really a lot of fun for me.
Oh yeah, that's what they do there.
Yeah.
Well, as far as editing them, I have to admit that particular forum is fairly new, and I've never edited anything on it before. We had an older form, and I knew how to do it. This is a little different one. And as far as I know, you are capable of editing your own posts, but I've never done that, and I will have to talk to the people who run that to find out for you. Are you wishing that someone would delete them for you, or
yes.
Or okay? Well,
yes,
I'll contact.
I'd still like to be free to participate in the forum. I just
we're glad to have you there. We're glad to have you there.
I don't want to professionally anyone to think I'm a professional representative.
Okay. Now, did you post under your own name or do you have a screen name?
Karen's Tricycle.
Okay, Karen's Tricycle.
Yes.
Okay. Then we'll know which ones are yours, and I actually imagine that the people who do that kind of stuff are probably listening, and they'll probably attend to it. But I'll check.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Karen, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Yeah, Karen's an LDS member who's been calling for a couple of years now quite frequently and just recently started on our forum. If you've never been to our Bible forum, you can post any question on anything, and someone's going to answer you. I mean, I might if I have time, and sometimes I do, If I don't, there's people who are every bit as good as me or better in giving answers, and you'll get a good answer, or at least some good discussion. It's theos.org, T-H-E-O-S.org. Let's talk to Richard next, who's calling from Westland, Oregon. And we've got lines open for you if you'd like to call. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Richard, thanks for calling. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yes, Steve, I had a question regarding your teaching in Exodus chapter 25, where you state that the Ark of the Covenant represents Jesus Christ, which I find very interesting. And the reason you state is that the Ark does represent Jesus Christ is because it's made of wood and gold, outlined with gold or surfaced with gold. And you quote many, several verses that bring this point out. And one of them needs a little help interpreting it. You said that the Apostle John, when he wrote Revelation, when he was on the island of Patmos, he said that he saw the pattern of the tabernacle in Revelation 4:1, and I think I kind of understand it, but could you go over that a little bit? Revelation 4:1, what John spoke of there speaks of the.
Let me clarify that. I'm not saying that in Revelation 4:1 that John claims that he saw the pattern of the tabernacle. What I'm saying is in Revelation 4:1, John was caught up into heaven, and he saw things he saw heavenly visions. And as you read the rest of the book of Revelation, you'll find that he described things that appear to be the heavenly counterparts of the tabernacle. You'll find that he saw the altar, probably the altar of incense, because the prayers of the saints were offered up with incense on the altar, which was, there was an altar of incense in the tabernacle. He saw the blood of martyrs and their souls under an altar, which is probably the altar of sacrifice, which was outside in the outer court of the tabernacle. He saw an ark. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, at the end of chapter 11. At the end of chapter 11, he saw the Ark of the Covenant in heaven. He saw, of course, the lampstands, not exactly like the ones in the tabernacle, because he saw seven lampstands in chapter 1, though in the tabernacle, the lampstand was a seven-branched single lampstand. But there's a number of things. There's a sea of glass, which is like the laver that was in the Temple of Solomon, probably, and other things that were there. And there's a Holy of Holies mentioned there, too. Now, these are all aspects of the tabernacle, and John seems to be seeing them in heaven. Now, what I was saying is that when Moses was given instructions to build the tabernacle on earth, God, on a number of occasions, said to him, see to it that you make everything exactly as according to the pattern that I showed you on the mountain. He means when Moses was up on Mount Sinai, God showed him a pattern, apparently a heavenly pattern, of the tabernacle, and told Moses, build the earthly tabernacle according to that pattern. Now, the writer of Hebrews makes an issue of this in both Hebrews chapter 8 and chapter 9. He talks about the reason that Moses was that it was emphasized that Moses must make the tabernacle according to the pattern is because the earthly tabernacle was to be in fact a pattern of heavenly things. So it is suggested that there was there's this heavenly prototype of the tabernacle, which is the pattern that Moses had to follow in making the earthly tabernacle. Now, what I said about Revelation is that John, when he's cut into heaven, seems to have seen this heavenly tabernacle because he mentions several of the items that correspond with the earthly tabernacle. I'm not saying that John, when he was caught up in chapter 4, verse 1, specifically said, I was caught up and I saw the heavenly tabernacle. But he does, after he is caught up into heaven in chapter 4, verse 1, there are a number of times where he sees these different furniture and so forth that were associated with the tabernacle. And so that's my reason for saying that he apparently saw the heavenly tabernacle even as Moses did.
I see. Okay, thanks very much for that explanation, Steve.
Well, thank you for your question. Feel free to call anytime. I can clarify something I said in a muddied way previously.
you do very well. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is also from Portland. We have a lot of calls from the Portland and other parts of Oregon area today, and that's fine. We welcome them all. James from Portland, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how are you doing, Steve?
Good.
Yeah, I just wanted to call about the second caller, about the prophecy and stuff like that.
Yes, gift of prophecy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you were talking about how you're not sure the difference and stuff like that, or the difference that you perceive it to be would be prophets usually know that they're prophets, and people that that are teachers usually teach the word, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what I said was that a person who has the office of a prophet must be somebody who's more certain than I would be. That some word that he has is really from God, because
The one thing I was going to add to it a little bit was in Jeremiah, when he was talking to Hananiah. I think you remember Hananiah in chapter 28.
Mm-hmm.
He did say, by what you're saying, where is your proof? And the proof, where I can see it is in the fruit of the tree, you know, the fruit of what they speak, what comes out of it. So by the prophecy that the prophets give, you can tell if they're from God or not. And, being chosen from God for prophecy, you're able to understand that, correct?
You're able to understand what? That you can understand...
That
I don't quite follow you.
You're able to speak for God. I mean, God is speaking through you.
If you are, if you speak prophetically, yes, you are then speaking for God. I mean, God is speaking through you.
Yeah, and what I was trying to clear up is the part where you were saying... it just seemed kind of unclear as far as prophets calling them apart from good prophets and bad prophets as far as being a prophet yourself.
Yeah, well, the Bible makes it clear in the Old Testament that, and in the New Testament, that prophecy is a gift that has to be judged because people can make a mistake. And in the Old Testament, there's two tests. One is in Deuteronomy 13 in the opening verses, and one is in Deuteronomy 18. And the two tests are, A, if a prophet leads you away from the true God, then his prophecy is false. And B, if the prophet predicts something and that doesn't come true, then that prophecy is false. And so those are a couple ways we would judge. In the New Testament, Paul said that no one would say that Jesus is accursed if he's speaking by the Spirit of God, so that'd be one way to test it. He also said that a prophet speaks to edification, exhortation, and comfort for the church, which I guess we could say we need to ask if a given prophetic word has those qualities or those effects, in which case it could be genuine if it does. Listen, I'm out of time. The music's playing. My apology for cutting you short, but I appreciate your call. Someone called and wanted to know the call numbers for the station in Chico area, Chico, California. That's KKXX in Chico, and I'm looking for the call numbers. I didn't have a chance to check it out here. I think it's 9:30 a.m. I believe it's 9:30 a.m. on the radio dial. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. Our website is www.thenarrowpath.com. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. Can't give you the address, so we're out of time. You can find it at our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion.